The world is becoming more unglued by the day. Local consequences are now showing up. We are seeing sky-high gas prices, higher food prices, shortages, and more. How should you respond? Go to redpills.tv/patriot. That's redpills.tv/patriot. And secure your long-term emergency food storage from My Patriot Supply. My Patriot Supply is by far the largest preparedness company in America. They're in stock and shipping quickly in unmarked boxes to your door. Their emergency food supplies last up to 25 years in storage. When you need it, it'll be there. Lunches, dinners, drinks, and snacks totaling over 2,000 calories a day. Get free shipping on any order over $99. Again, go to redpills.tv/patriot.
Let's all embark on another journey of Conversations on the Fringe.
Well, happy Friday 13th, everybody. My name is Josh, and welcome to the Red Pill Project's Conversations on the Fringe. I almost said Daily Dose. Oh, my goodness. Conversations on the Fringe. This is where we explore the extraordinary and everything above it. This is where we go deep into the mind and talk about the things that aren't normally talked about. This is where we kind of just go into the strange and explore the wonder and amazement of our universe. I hope everybody's having a great Friday. My day started with two different recordings, so I'm happy to be here on Fringe Friday. Just it's great to do this show, man. This show is like the one thing that makes my week. And yes, it is Friday the 13th for everybody out there chatting about it. Our guest tonight, Keith Thompson, is an author, independent journalist, and explorer of the exceptional and supernormal mind-body capacities as potential indicators of the future evolution of human nature. Thompson's book, Angels and Aliens, UFOs and the Mythic Imaginations, was hailed by the San Francisco Chronicle as magnificent. No matter what your beliefs, the most fascinating book written on the subject, and by Venture World as probably the most profound book on the UFO controversy yet to appear. He has a new book coming up out called Cosmos Calling. Please welcome Keith Thompson to the show. Keith, how are we doing today?
Joshua, I'm doing great, and I had not fully cognized that it is Friday the 13th, and we're going to be meeting Friday the 13th on the Fringe, so I'm going to have both feet on the floor. Let me do a quick mantra here for protection. Okay, good. I'm ready to go.
All right, fantastic. Well, you know, I'm not very superstitious myself. I mean, Friday the 13th, a lot of people attribute to the Knights Templars. This was the day that I believe it was Pope Innocent declared them treasonous and called for their execution, and they went down and hunted them down, tortured them, and eventually killed them. And I think now the Templars are actually getting their revenge, but that's a different story for another day. But I just, you know, well, I am superstitious. I'm like the guy who rubs a slot machine. I'm the rabbit foot. I hold crystals to a certain degree. Friday the 13th doesn't bother me, though. It's 13th, well, my favorite number.
I'm not that superstitious, but I will tell you about 10 days ago, I was getting ready to go on a trip, which I'd be happy to talk about. Went down to Pascagoula, Mississippi, as you certainly will recall, I'm guessing with your knowledge of the UFO phenomenon, the Pascagoula incident of 1973 was and continues to be one of the most remarkable close encounters of all times. One of the original participants, Calvin Parker, is still alive. So as part of my research for my book, my field work, went down to see Calvin Parker. So what I'm leading up to is on the morning that I get up to catch a flight, actually three flights to get to Pascagoula, I had my window open during the night. It was kind of a warm night. I woke up at 10 till 5 to the sound of an owl outside my window. I live in a what feels like the country, but it's within city limits in the state of Idaho. So I'm not unused to hearing or seeing an owl, but I don't believe I've ever woken up to one. And I sat there, I said, "Brother, you better take this as an omen. You're getting on a plane, getting onto three planes. You're going to Pascagoula, which you've never been to the deep South before. So there's another kind of initiatory experience for me. And I'm going down to explore the UFO phenomenon." So I actually lay there. I said, "I'm happy to make this an omen, and I'm going to make it a good omen." I made a point of saying the owl was my friend, and it's welcoming me to have an extraordinary experience.
I love the symbol of the owl, and this is something that I actually talk about, and I hope that this can bring some brightness to your day. There's mythological stories surrounding the owl. Now, the owl is representative in two different contexts in the occult. One as the bringer and harbinger of omens at night, and the other one as the carrier of wisdom. The derivation of wisdom for the wild owl derives from the crossover of a mixture of two different goddesses, one from ancient Greeks and one from ancient Rome. And this would be Athena and Minerva.
Minerva, yes.
Yep. Now, Athena was born out of the forehead of Zeus. She's the only god born in the pantheon that was not birthed by a mother, but instead by the forehead of Zeus, which she was born with all the knowledge of all the gods. Athena didn't trust mankind with the knowledge, so she hid it from them. And this is where you transition over to Minerva, which has a very similar story. It's a corresponding goddess in Roman mythology, and she didn't trust mankind. This is the goddess of fertility, of knowledge, and wisdom. Didn't trust mankind with the wisdom of the ancient worlds and of the gods. So she hid the knowledge in the darkness in the owl. And the owl is the occulting, is representative of the occulting of knowledge. And so there's also a derivation here when you go into like the occult origins of evil, of Satanism and Luciferianism, is when you shine a light on the owl in darkness, it casts a shadow. Now the shadow that it casts is a longhorn shadow, and this is the birth of Baal or Lucifer or Satan in many different contexts. If you remember Bohemian Grove, how they worshipped the cremation of cure, and they had the big owl, which was representative of Moloch, Baal, same god. And this is what it is. It's the false light, the deceptive light shone on the owl of knowledge that cast a shadow, of which the Adept initiate, whoever it is, seeks the shadow as the true bearer of the wisdom instead of the owl. Of which you have to look at the owl with the true light, which is the light from within the soul, to see the knowledge or the wisdom the owl presents.
Well, you have just laid a very fine foundation. As you probably know, the owl is also a recurring image in the phenomenon of alien abductions.
It is.
For example, Whitley Strieber, one of the most famous abductees of our time, I believe 1986, had his big experience that he wrote about in a book called Communion. Mm-hmm. And part of what he reported was that he saw an owl on his window. He later discovered the owl wasn't really there, or concluded that it wasn't, but that doesn't mean that its significance would only be that it was a physical bird outside his window. The owl was there. And it is also a recurring image in other abductee experiences, which is why I am inclined to this may segue into what we're going to talk about, or one way to talk about it is, I don't think the alien phenomenon, alien abduction phenomenon, begins in 1947. Mm-hmm. I think that is certainly a chapter. It is the modern era of the UFO phenomenon. I think many in the field of UFO studies are inclined to, you know, the nuts and bolts school likes to believe it did happen in 1947, and let's keep all this mythology and folklore out of the story. Well, as you probably know, Jacques Vallée is one of the most impressive researchers in the field, and he opened up the door to this larger question. He wrote a book called Passport to Magonia. Magonia was a mythical realm in French and European folklore. And there are remarkable parallels between or among the UFO phenomena, the fairy Celtic fairy faith, and shamanic encounters, interactions with non-ordinary beings that shamans throughout the world have interacted with. So by introducing the owl, we're really introducing a larger framework for the UFO that takes it really into a much broader picture. And we could certainly go into lots of different, we could explore deeply, and always aware that there are plenty of rabbit holes that we can go down, get lost in. I've learned to recognize, I think, Keith, this is a rabbit hole, and you're going to eventually have to turn around and walk back out. So why don't you do that now?
Right. Well, Keith, I want to get started on this conversation. So can you tell me what got you interested in UFOs to begin with? How did you come about the courage, I guess, to write your first book, and what really led to it?
Okay, I'd be glad to. And as a matter of fact, today I'm writing this new book called Cosmos Calling, and it is in the wake of my first book, Angels and Aliens. So I am today at my computer writing a draft of my prologue, the opening to the book. As you know, probably a prologue is actually what is, it's almost the last thing that you write too, because you have to write the book in order to know how you're going to introduce it, because you have to introduce what you ended up writing. But at this point, this is how I imagine. I'm going to read a paragraph for you. Okay. It's how I imagine writing the book, because it actually describes how it's my introduction to the book, and it describes how I got interested in the UFO phenomenon. I first heard about UFOs when I was 12 years old. Our local newspaper, combined with national TV shows, were blazing with stories of strange sightings in the skies over the Ann Arbor region of Michigan. Sheriff's deputies told of seeing disc-shaped objects flashing star-like streaks of red and green across the dark morning sky with fantastic speed. The media frenzy coincided with my turn to give a current events report in my Northwest Ohio classroom, age 12. With the enthusiasm of a cub reporter, I chose this UFO sighting that stirred debate throughout the United States for more than a week. So I essentially, it was my turn to give a current events report. And the story that was in the news, was this in nearby Michigan, this week-long national news, Walter Cronkite, then the host of the CBS Evening News, for several nights in a row led the opening of the show in his marvelous voice. Good evening, this is Walter Cronkite. The UFO sightings in Ann Arbor continue to amaze the nation. We go to Bob Schieffer. Bob? And I was glued to the whole thing. And so I gave a report about it. Now, I don't know if you know about the Hillsdale, Michigan Ann Arbor sighting. It was the sighting where the legendary UFO researcher, J. Allen Hynek, who was the Air Force guy, an astronomer that the Air Force had brought in to be their spokesman on UFOs. What he didn't know for a long time, Josh, is that he was essentially employed to debunk it all. He didn't know that. A lot of it could be debunked. See, that's the thing. Maybe 8 out of 10 of what would get called UFO sightings do have prosaic explanations. That still leaves 10%. That's a lot. So he came to Michigan. He looked at it all. It was an uproar. It was a frenzy because, you know, the dynamic between those who say something extraordinary is going on versus the debunkers who show up constantly. I consider them comic characters. By debunker, I mean those who have a closed mind, not a true skeptic. You're a skeptic. I'm a skeptic. I mean, a skeptic in the deep sense is saying, well, show me the proof. Show me the evidence. And I'll open to it if there's solid grounds to believe. But I won't believe based on faith. The debunker is almost one who does act on faith. They're not real. They can't be real. There's nothing in science that tells us this is real. So anyway, this was the uproar. Hynek came in, did some investigation. Turns out there were some of these lights that were seen near a swamp on the edge of town. And he said, he let slip the phrase, in a few cases, ladies and gentlemen, these could be swamp gas. And this was the first, he did not explain it all away as swamp gas. Well, again, I'm through my 12-year-old mind, the prism of my mind, watching all of this. And I shared the outrage of many news media people who said, how dare this guy, especially the people of Michigan. They said, we may be from rural Michigan, but we're not complete rubes. We know the difference between these events moving quickly through the sky and swamp gas. Mm-hmm. So it became a national scandal. And I was hooked, Josh. I was hooked. I did not become, I didn't go to UFO clubs. I didn't get a UFO badge. I didn't join any of that. But I was interested in, here's what I was interested in. Time after time, extraordinary sightings are described by credible people. Time after time, these debunkers say, no, you didn't. No, it wasn't. It couldn't be. We're the arbiters of reality. We're big science. Mm-hmm. Thank you for checking in. And I noticed that cancellation would always happen. And over time, as I became more sophisticated, as I got older than 12, I began to see that that very debate drives this phenomenon into the depths of the human psyche and makes the celestial UFO from the sky a metaphysical UFO. And that's where we look at Carl Jung's contribution. That's where we bring in the symbolic studies, the metaphysical issues. The UFO, I keep saying, I say to many people when I talk about this, there are many ufologists who want aliens without anomalies. They don't want our model of reality to be disturbed. These are simply got to be craft that are a little further along than our own technology. But reality gets to stay as it is. My analysis of this thing for quite a few years, I'm quite a few years older than 12 now, and my observation is we don't get aliens without anomalies. There are anomalous dimensions. By anomalies, I simply mean those phenomena that cross the line between mind and body, that are called synchronicities, that are what's going on at Skinwalker Ranch. I'm sure you know about that. That stuff is real. So we have to, in other words, deal with the paranormal if we're going to deal with the UFO.
Yeah, and I like this. Dr. Bruce Solheim, who's been on the show a few times, he's been at Contact in the Desert. He's a medium, but he talks a lot about these different topics, and he talks about something known as the quantum nexus. I think he even coined this term. And so he deals a lot with paranormal because he's a psychic, but then he's also dealt with extraterrestrial stuff and then what he would claim as interdimensional stuff. And he said, you know, Joshua, this is interesting because if you take everything down to the base foundation, which is one thing that I do, I have to take everything down to the base foundation of learning and understanding, the base dynamics, whether it's etymology, whether it's the historical context, references, I always have to take things down to the base. And I said, okay. And he goes, what is the one thing that all of these various experiences or entities have in common? I don't know. He goes, they all appear to be conscious. Which means that conscious is the fundamental unifying factor of the paranormal, of the interdimensional, and of the extraterrestrial. And this is where we come into what he calls the quantum nexus, is that we are all one accent of each other on the quantum level, just varying different levels of consciousness.
Well, yeah, indeed. The question of consciousness is crucial. It's a big topic. We can delve into it somewhat, but it is one that, again, much of mainstream ufology doesn't want to deal with. I tend to follow UFO Twitter, right? The Twitter conversation about UFOs. There are some smart people on this, so that's why I pay attention. And at the same time, the entry bar to become a UFO observer is pretty low. Mm-hmm. I'm struck by the number of people on Twitter, UFO Twitter, who clearly haven't done any real delving. So I heard someone the other day, read somebody saying, what does this mean when people say we have to explore the nature of consciousness? And then he said, are they saying that UFOs are merely subjective? So again, this is the kind of, we are caught between a rock and a hard place. But what I mean by that, they're not merely subjective. What the UFO does is cut right between the cleavage. This is the cleavage. Over here is objective. Over here is subjective. The subjective is the realm of the observer, thoughts, feelings, inner life. Objective is supposedly out there. The UFO says, nice division, but we're not going to acknowledge it. Mm-hmm. They continue to appear in forms that undercut the division between mind and matter, spirit and physicality, inner and outer, objective and subjective. This is why the experiences are life-changing. That's why they resemble Ezekiel's wheel, Moses and the burning bush. I do think those are descriptions of the same phenomenon, which is not to say, Moses saw flying saucers. No, the flying saucer frame of reference is a contemporary way meta system. Let's put it this way.
You're spot on. Yep.
The UFO frame of reference, the saucer frame of reference, is a system, and it is produced by a meta system, I believe, that says, in our age, we expect things to be technological. So it gives us technological stuff. In other ages, in the Middle Ages, where angels were the stock in trade, then these beings took the form of angels. In other words, this phenomenon, and it's crucial, you touched on it, this is an intelligence. Mm-hmm. And it is an intelligence that, in some sense, I believe its purpose, or at least its effect, is to shape human belief in new ways. And that's why I'm describing in my book, I'm calling it Cosmos Calling, because I think the UFO is a call from the cosmos. Now, and the book is going to be what that call is. The broadest sense I'd put it, Joshua, is this way. It's calling on us to wake up and play a bigger game.
Yep.
There's more to our, we ask, what are UFOs made of? Amazing how often that question always points back to what are we made of? We're not going to figure out the UFO's makeup without exploring our own. We don't get out of this thing in our current state. We are an evolving animal. We're spiritual beings having a human life. It's one way to talk about it. But we are paranormal ourselves, okay? But we're not in touch with that part of ourselves very often. I think the UFO is an enticement to step into larger dimensional aspects of our own being.
All right, I'm going to share something with you. And a few people knew, they saw me smiling when you were saying this. And I hope that this, maybe from my experience, is validation for what you all just said there. Back in about 2009, I was heavily into various aspects of the occult, magic aspects. And I used to be able to get into very, very trance-like meditations. And I used to do them before bed and go into these meditations. I had a hypnosis session one time where I met this being. And this being, a being of light. And she kind of guided me and helped me, gave me a lot of knowledge throughout life. And this one night I go into this kind of meditative trance. And it's kind of cool. I mean, you're like... It's seconds are hours in the real world, right? And so the experience in this realm is very prolonged in the real world. But I hear a voice right here in my left ear, and it's saying, Josh, Josh. And so I follow the voice with my consciousness, and I'm kind of going through this kind of this darkness, and it kind of comes to a light. And at the light, I see just kind of glimmers of light going back and forth, and they're communicating, they're talking. And I go, hi. And she's like, what are you doing here? I'm like, well, what do you mean, what am I doing here? She goes, you shouldn't be here right now. And I'm like, but I am. I heard my name. She goes, but I'm talking to you right now. So you can't be here right now. And so then she kind of comes down and it just gives me this idea in my mind that I can't see them. Everything that I'm perceiving of them is an illusion created by my mind. My mind is trying to interpret the the information that's coming from a higher dimensional or vibrational level. And so what my mind does is it pulls from its memory stores the best interpretation it can of what's actually happening. And she goes, this is all phenomena, from ghosts to spirits to shadow figures to UFOs to alien abductions. It's all this way, is that things that are beyond your perceptual ability, beyond your dimensional perspective, are basically interpreted through your brain the best that it can. And it usually will go to social and cultural aspects that are currently trending to depict what it actually is. And it hit me. I'm like, UFOs, flying saucers, the progression from a saucer to a triangle to these different levels of technology. The next day, I'm listening to Elliot in the Morning in Washington, D.C. I think it was 95 or 103.5. And he had Sammy Hagar from Van Halen on. And Sammy Hagar had just written his autobiography, and he talked about the time that he was abducted by aliens in Cabo San Lucas. And he said that it was the weirdest thing in the world. They left my body right there, but they took my consciousness. And it was crazy because everything that I looked at them, how I perceived them, was all a formulation, a creation of my mind, and I never perceived them in their true form, only what my mind believed them to be. And so what you just said was mind-blowing, because it was spot on with exactly what I've been saying for the longest time. And it comes from two different levels of experience.
Wow, that's great. First of all, I didn't know about Sammy Hagar's experience. Yeah. When I lived in California, I had crossed paths with Sammy one day. Very fun. He and his wife at the time anyway, quite a couple. I don't know if he was Van Halen at the time, but he was Sammy Hagar.
Red rocker. And then,
yeah, a total rocker, an amazing guy. There is, you know, what you're describing, there's one part of what you said I want to touch on. This is something that we all have to do all the time. Imagine a kid, you know, learning to make, say him, a kid making his way, an infant, making his way, learning what things are. He learns, he or she, but I'll just say he because I don't want to keep saying he or she, learns that a furry animal with four legs and a tail is a doggy. And there are more than one kind of dog. He sees other kind of doggies. One day he sees a new kind of doggy, which he doesn't know is a cat. But it fits every other aspect of a dog. It's furry, has four legs and a tail. Doesn't say bow wow, it says meow. So at this point, he's got the category that furry, four legs and tail. We all attempt to assimilate new experiences into our existing categories. And there are times when we are required, in order to learn and cognitively develop, we have to allow our belief systems to accommodate something different. Mm-hmm. So then now there are two things in the category of furry, tail, four legs, dogs, cats, zebras, giraffes, it goes on and on and on. So you've just described the first step is, how do I assimilate this into my existing belief system? And there are cases that it's not possible. The belief system has to expand. And part of the dilemma with that is a social dilemma. How do you reveal, how do you talk about experiences of this magnitude, an abduction, being taken with details that, well, let me, if I could, I began by talking about Pascagoula. Let me tell you the story of Pascagoula, Mississippi. Two men, 49-year-old Charles Hickson and 19-year-old Calvin Parker. They're both steel workers, or I should say shipyard workers. The age difference was that it was the first day Calvin had started at the shipyard, Walker Shipyard. And at the end of the day, Charles Hickson said, Calvin, would you like to go fishing? I sure would. And they both love fishing. So they went home, had their dinner, had their showers, and they met, and they drove off to a place to cast their lines for the night. Wasn't a good place. They moved to another location. That wasn't a good place. Finally, they went on private property and walked out on a pier. And Calvin Parker, who is now, he was 19 at the time, is now 70 years old, said, Charlie, we're going to get arrested here. And by the way, I was just down in Mississippi, so I'll be slipping in and out of my Pascagoula accent. He said, Charlie, we're going to get arrested here. This is probably not a good place for us to be. And Charlie said, don't worry, it'll be all right. Well, so they're catching fish. Sure enough, Charlie sees reflected on the water blue light. And he says, well, Charlie, I told you, the police are here. Now I'm going to spend the night in jail, and so are you. They turned around. It wasn't the police. Hmm. It was a craft. I would say an apparent craft. You know, we always have to say an apparent. It appeared to them to be a craft. But I've learned to, you know, at some point you have to stop, start dropping the phrase apparent, and it seemed to be. Of course it seemed to be. Well, it was blue and white and shimmering, and then the a door opened up like on Star Trek. These guys are not Star Trek fans. Yeah. They're not influenced by science fiction. They are high school graduates, maybe, in Pascagoula, Mississippi, okay? And there were only a couple of, only one major UFO abduction that had taken place at the time. That was Betty and Barney Hill. They didn't know about it. So with that as a framework, the door opened up, a bright light, and out came three creatures. That's what they described them to be, creatures, about 5 feet tall, gray, with what appeared to be carrot, like ears like carrot sticks, nose like carrot sticks, eyes that didn't appear to be eyes if they were. They had legs, but they were floating. Both of these men were paralyzed, unable to move. Two of them came on each side of Calvin, took him, and oh, by the way, as they were approaching them telepathically, by the way, Calvin had never had a telepathic experience. He probably didn't know the word, let alone the experience. He got a mental statement from them, says, don't worry, we're not going to hurt you. We mean you no harm. And it's nice to hear when two or three creatures are grabbing you and taking you inside this thing. And he said the light inside was as bright as a welder's arc, which is, if you know anything about, well, that's pretty bright.
Yeah.
And then, so long story short, they put them through procedures, an examination of some kind, still paralyzed, terrified. So they then released them out onto the shore. Calvin fell to his knees, crying and weeping, 19 years old. Charlie, who'd been to Korea for war, had at least had some trauma in his life. But for Calvin, it was the first trauma. I can't imagine a worse trauma. So they stood there and they agreed, we'll never tell anybody. We can't tell anybody. And they were stopped 15 minutes. They were overwhelmed. And this thing, by the way, disappeared. It didn't just fly off. It just disappeared, literally dematerialized. And by the way, there were later sightings. Other witnesses saw a blue light. So there were secondary sighting. By the way, it doesn't necessarily make us extraterrestrial yet.
Right.
Could be something from another dimension that opened up. We don't know, but that's a larger question. Wormholes in physics, quantum physics, there are various models for multiple worlds. They may be right here, close to this, to us, and under certain circumstances, things translate in a way that open us to a larger set of dimensions. So with that as a framework, Charlie, the older one, said, we got to call the Air Force. They had an Air Force base nearby. We got this. This could be an invasion, Charlie. And that was a reasonable, or Calvin, that's a reasonable position. So they called the Air Force. The Air Force says, we don't investigate this stuff anymore. Call your local law enforcement. And Calvin said, please, Charlie, do not call the local police. We do not. They did call the local sheriff. Sheriff brought them in. They sat with them separately. They saw how absolutely terrorized they both were, especially Calvin. Calvin was truly, and this is a traumatic, this is like an assault, to say the least. As John Mack, Dr. John Mack at Harvard, who went on to study the abductions, called it ontological shock. Ontology is the division of philosophy that deals with the nature of being. Mm-hmm. Well, an ontological shock is a shock to your very sense of what is possible. What is real? That could not have happened, what just happened to these old boys, good old boys. And it did happen to them. So I'll bring this to an end by saying this. They met with them privately. They told them to tell the story over and over. They got pretty fed up with it. And then they set up a tape recorder in a cell and then put them both in this, a secret tape recorder, a hidden tape recorder. Put them both in there and said, we got some calls to make. You boys just sit here and then we'll let you go home. They closed the door. Now, if it was a hoax, You think they would have said, well, we got it going now. Now we got to keep it up and we'll get on TV and we'll get a book deal and a movie. You know, that kind of talk mm-hmm. is what you would have expected, or else from psychologically deranged individuals. Instead, these are guys. Calvin is still weeping. I'd like to have gone crazy out there. That thing held me up and I couldn't move my arm. I'm about out of my mind with terror about that. I need to sleep in Pilton. I mean, just the kind of stuff. Charlie said, well, I need me a drink for sure. And I'll get you a sleeping pill. I'll get you a room or get you home, son. Don't worry. But they talk for about 10 minutes, entirely consistent with, this is what caused the sheriff to say, well, these guys have had a real experience. Dr. Hynek flew down. Some other researchers flew down, interviewed them and said, if these guys are acting, they deserve the Academy Award. We don't know where what they saw came from, but they had an experience.
Wow.
And so it went on. It became one of the greatest cases. It's now 50 years later. And as I said, I went down to Pascagoula at the invitation of Calvin, who's the only one left, because I wanted to see how it's sitting with him 50 years later. Wanted to also talk to some of the other witnesses. So that's part of what I'll be doing in the book, is revisiting Pascagoula. Had a wonderful time, wonderful human being. Mostly I was impressed by his normalcy at this point of his life. He has integrated the experience. And you know what? He continues to say, I don't know what happened. Something happened. He said, it may be from dimensions. I don't understand how that works. I am not an educated man. He's very forthright about not having the kind of education that would so seemingly go with it. He was persuaded to write a book. Finally, let me share that story with you real briefly. Yeah. He and his wife went to a funeral back in 2016. And Calvin had learned to stop identifying himself by his name, because Pascagoula is a small town. And he didn't want to have to be Calvin Parker of that incident. So he signed the funeral registry with his real name. Someone looks over his shoulder and says, well, are you Calvin Parker? And Calvin said, oh, God. Yeah, I'm Calvin Parker. But two or three others came over and they tell us your story. We want to meet you. Can we take our picture? And Calvin turned to his wife and said, well, this isn't right. We're here for a funeral. This is not respectful. So they exited the scene, got in the car. And by the way, a publisher had that week contacted Calvin and said, would you be interested in reconsidering and doing a book with us? And in the car, his wife, Wynette, turned to Calvin and said, Calvin, you got to write that book because you have got to deal with this. And do you know what? And that was 2017 or so. Do you know that between 1973, when the incident happened, and 2017, Calvin Parker had never told his wife the full story on his own? She'd read about what he was reported to have said, but he was continued to be so traumatized and so disturbed, he kept it within.
Wow.
And it was only in the process of actually writing the book, even though he wasn't a writer, he wrote it in his Mississippi way, first person, and that was a big part of what he found very healing to finally bring it forward. So anyway, I've given you one of the best cases in UFO research, and it's one that I'm going to be revisiting with the kind of details I've told you here.
That's fascinating, and I'm going to get your book because I want to find out how this sits with Calvin 50 years later. And so I urge everybody to go to your website, which is thompsonatlarge.com, and you guys can check out everything there. I'm curious, other than the Ann Arbor sightings, have you had any experiences yourself with either the with UFOs, aliens, whatever it might be, paranormal, any type of experiences?
Well, I have. I have not had UFO experiences, but I have had an experience that I have that, you know, that like Calvin, I kept to myself for reasons that I'll make clear. I used to call it a near-death experience, but I finally come to realize I had a death experience. I experienced death. I experienced dying. And I came back. So in that sense, it wasn't permanent bodily death. I'll give you a brief overview. I went in my mid-20s went to Hawaii with friends, and we went body surfing one day on a beach called Sunset Beach. Anybody who knows North Honolulu, North Oahu knows that beach. It's site of surfing championships. They have signs that are not temporary signs. They're permanent signs. Don't go in there, or be very, very careful. The undertow, the waves. We were feeling our oats. We were young. We were immortal. We were invulnerable. We played along the edges. And then I love body surfing in warm water. It is heavenly experience for me. And I've had my share of it in this blessed life. So I get out. I start, you know, hitting the surf. And I, long story short, I lost it. I got taken out too far. Combination of undertow and waves coming from behind me. So the waves from behind me crash, the undertow pulled me further out, crash. And what I was doing, let me just put this out there to anybody who does ocean swimming, playing in the ocean. If you're ever caught in undertow, riptides, swim parallel to the beach. Don't fight them. Find a place where they're not there and then let the waves from behind wash you onto the shore. But if you're swimming against riptides, you will exhaust yourself and you probably won't survive. I got far enough out there. And my friends on shore were saying, you know, they're calling me, get in. Somebody came out on a surfboard, offered it to me. He tried to swim, and then the surfboard got blown, you know, the waves blew it out of my hands. And I thought, I remember the scene that I said, I'm going to die. And I got taken by a huge breaker, crashed to the floor. And when I came back up, I was really up. I was looking down on the beach. When I say I, let me say what I mean by this. I, the sense of being an aware being as you are right now, when you say I, you're referring to this perspective. My perspective was 360 degrees. I was not only seeing my friends on the beach calling to my body, I saw my body. I was aware that I was not seeing from my body. I was seeing from outside my body. And I had a very clear and lucid moment, as is often the case with dying experiences. I said, oh, dead isn't dead. And because my body was lifeless, it was being on, you know, being like a doll. It used to be Keith. Now I saw the body that used to be me. And in some sense, I was still engaged with. Went through the stages of the near-death experience, a tunnel, brilliant light, sounds, music, a sense of a heaven-like place. I say heaven-like because I was not raised with a strong Christian background, but I know what heaven is supposed to look like. I saw deceased relatives. I saw beings that did not appear to be quite human, mythological creatures. I was engaged with a wisdom force that talk with me, that we communicated telepathically, mind to mind. What was I learning about life? Long story short, it wasn't one of those things if you're going back because you're not ready, but you have more to learn, or I had more to learn. And I, next thing I knew, I was seeing the world again through this body. I saw the shore. My friends were waiting out. I had found I was back in the body, and I had found a cove that was carrying me, and I was kind of beaten up, not badly injured, but kind of bat wrecked. Let me just tell you what the significance of this was.
Yeah.
When I was on the beach, my friends were reviving me and not doing mouth to mouth resuscitation, but I was stunned. I was in shock. You know, dying is hard on the body. to say the least. It's not a victory for the body. It's a trauma for the body. But I came back with, even though I was in the body again, I'd recognized that I had, oh, one more detail, Josh. It was very significant. That was decisive for me. Not only did I see my friends see my body in the water and see my friends on the shore and see everything as awareness itself, as limitless, boundless, infinite. I heard my friend Mary on the shore, frustrated and a little bit pissed off, saying to our other friend, it was a bunch of buddies, said, why didn't he listen? I told him it was too rough. This was based on the assumption that my body would be retrieved and would be sent back in a body bag. I awareness was suddenly at the side of Mary. And I was telling her, I am fine. There's nothing wrong. I'm okay. She couldn't hear me. I could hear her. That was another sign that this was not the game. The game I'd been playing was different.
Yeah.
Well, at the level of anomalies, the next day after I survived and back in the body and was, they were taking care of me. And I said, Mary, I'd like to tell you something. Let's go for a walk. She was a platonic friend. Her boyfriend was Jim, and they were there on the, she was a good buddy.
Yeah.
And she goes, what do you want to tell me? And I said, well, I need to tell you, you remember when you were on the shore and I was in the water? She said, yeah. I said, I heard you say, Keith, why didn't you listen to me? Why didn't he listen to me? I told him not to go in. And she goes, her face, the blood drained from her face. Now, when I say, when she said that, my body was probably 200 yards out into the water. And the amount of noise from the waves, and it was big crashing waves. It was a crazy thing that I got caught up in. We both knew what it meant. By the way, one more detail. This was after the book Life After Life had been written.
Ah.
But only 4 years after. Oprah had not made the near-death experience famous. Raymond Moody had written the book, but it was not yet famous. I had never heard of it. I was too busy living life as a 24-year-old to be interested in people who have near-death. I had never heard of the NDE, near-death experience, which was significant in two ways. Number one, I had not memorized the stages of a near-death experience, and therefore that's what I had because I was expecting, you know, the expectancy explanation. Oh, you hear about these and you imitate them. I had no idea. And the other thing that made it significant, Josh, is that I could not get anybody. When I was on the beach afterwards, a good friend of mine, Moore, said, buddy, we thought you'd eaten it out there. And we thought that you'd die. And I naively, I should say, matter of factly, looked at it as an opening. I said, I did. I did die. And he looked, I could tell by the look in his eyes, everybody's look was, Keith is traumatized. Mm-hmm. Keith is maybe hysterical. One friend was a psychologist, so she went to the psychological explanation. Good analysis, reasonable. They'd never heard of the NDE either. You don't die and come back.
Right.
So I learned quickly over time, like Calvin Parker. I had one after telling more and more about more and more circumstances, you know, at a party. Keith, tell us about what happened to you in Hawaii. So I would tell them, I would, one after another, find that you wouldn't be believed. You need trauma therapy. It's a good thing to get, by the way, if you've had this kind of an experience. I came to realize there's a poem by the German poet Goethe. There's a line from this poem that goes like this: "Tell a wise person, or else keep silent, for the mass person." The person of the masses will mock it right away. Tell a wise person or else keep silent, because the ordinary person will mock it right away.
Wow.
Love it. I came across that poem, and it relates to people who've had abduction experiences. It relates to any kind of life transformed experience. You need to tell somebody who can understand, who's also had it, or else keep silent. So I kept silent. So this is a long answer to your question. I kept silent. I shared it with a few people. Fortunately, around this time, the near-death experience did get to be famous, get to be well-known. I found, I went through all the things that I later found the near-death experience includes, a life review process in which everything is revealed to you. Wisdom is downloaded, which has taken me years to embody and bring forward. Well, in any case, I never have written about it. I didn't write about it in my first book. I am going to bring this experience forward in this book because I am not doing, you know, I'm doing this work as an empiricist. I'm taking an empirical approach But my view is that we have to have a broad-based empiricism that includes physical experience, mental experience, emotional experience, and spiritual experience. These are all experiences, and the empirical approach studies it all. So I'm bringing my own experience in. It's not a book about my own experience, but I will bring it forward because I'm not going to any longer conceal that this is a framework that has continued to change how I see and the significance of consciousness. I'll tell you one piece that is in place for me, Josh. I came back. I've had conflict. I've had struggles back in the material world. We all have, you know, relationships and difficulties. Mm-hmm. But something left me that has never come back. And that was what left me was any fear of death, any fear of dying. I have no, you know, people say, does consciousness survive the physical body? It's death. I kind of laugh when I hear that. I said, consciousness survives because consciousness precedes. Consciousness is here before we're born. It is the ground of our being. And it comes through us seemingly through our five senses, but it is the frame in which the five senses are, you know, the consciousness isn't in the body. All of this is in consciousness. I don't know how deeply I'm going to try to develop that in the book, but I'm convinced consciousness is here before we are, and consciousness continues. What form it takes? Gee, we could talk about reincarnation. There's really some good evidence for these children who remember past lives. And there's also the scenario of heaven-like pictures, which are very consistent with Christian and Islamic. So is it reincarnation? Or is it a permanent place where you go after death? It could be both.
Yeah.
There could be levels of choice. Anyway, these are big questions that'll take us beyond the UFO frame, but I'm gonna pry this thing open a little wider than most people are prepared to look at.
Well, this is Fringe. So the conversation is okay, because I think that these conversations need to be had and explored in these various topics, especially the UFO phenomena. Because I'm a firm believer that this connection to the metaphysical, to the spiritual, is direct. That many people look at the old ancient religious stories that come about, Ezekiel's wheel, as you mentioned before, and they look at this as angelic. Well, why can't it be? Why couldn't? Maybe it was both. Maybe it was perceived as this is something that's godly, heavenly, spiritual, and this was their way of describing it, but it was also technological in its perspective, that it was both spiritual and technological. It was both advanced civilization as well as spiritually advanced, more than us, and therefore guidance, therefore, you know, bringing a message, right?
Yes. Well, you know, the way when people say, what's the essence, Keith, of the UFO, just in the UFO frame of reference, the saucer frame of reference, the essence is really, there's two ways to look at it. This is either a physical phenomenon that, and by the way, it shows up on radar, shows up on other sensors. The military has had a long-term interest in this phenomenon. The amount of deception that we've had truly has not served our health of our democracy. But it's at least a physical phenomenon that at the same time has profound effects in terms of our consciousness, altered states of consciousness. Or this is primarily an intelligence that has physical effects. Either one. You can come, it works either way. You can look at it as a physical technology that has profound paranormal effects on mind and consciousness, or it is primarily a form of intelligence that has physical effects. But either way, it cuts across the quick of that division. Let me tell you another story that I've recently been playing with. You know Ken Arnold?
Yes.
Was the pilot who saw... First, 1947, saw nine discs over the what appeared to be discs. They actually appeared to be, what is the word for the particular shape? Scorpion. They were actually scorpion-like. In any case, they were nine objects that were. He didn't say they were shaped like saucers. He said they skipped like saucers over water. Mm-hmm. And he landed. He was out on a search mission to find a crashed plane. It was a reward, $5,000. Wasn't a small amount in 1947. I don't think he found it. Maybe he did. In any case, he found something else. He found this phenomenon. Well, so it was widely perceived. At first he thought these might be Russian, but there were aspects of this that he didn't talk about openly, because he was already thought to be kind of a nut for simply seeing what were called flying saucers, extraterrestrial spaceships. He never said that, but that's what it became. This was a post-war jittery period, mm-hmm. and concerned about the Russians and so forth. His daughter, after dad died, gave an interview. She said, "I want to set the record straight. I want to say what my father described to us and what happened to us as a result of this phenomenon." So let's pause right there and say that the UFO phenomenon in the modern age, the creation myth of the UFO world, is the Kenneth Arnold story. It's the origin myth, right? It's where it all begins. So it sets the stage for all to come. When I say a creation myth, primal people in the Aboriginal world of Australia and elsewhere have creation myths. This is where our people, we descended from the stars. This is our story. And these stories are told through the centuries. Well, and likewise, the creation myth of ufology was what Kenneth Arnold discovered. Well, his daughter Kim Arnold came forward after he died. So let me tell you what else my father experienced that day. He didn't tell the full story. He said he saw these objects, they were shimmering with blue and white light. One of them that passed close lit up his cockpit, quote, like a welder's arc. Now, isn't that an interesting two uses of the, I don't want to make too much of it. Let's just say very bright light. But the Pascagoula guys, like a welder's light, the Kenneth Arnold in his cockpit, and the nature of the light was so astonishing that it left him with a deep sense of something other dimensional. He said they were blue white light. They were transparent in different densities. He said, I was convinced she said, my dad never said they were mechanical. He never thought there was anything mechanical about them. He thought they were living and they pulsated like the human heart. Okay, now right there, we have a frame of reference in the original story that never got told. So in the UFO creation myth, we now know there was a larger set of details. He didn't describe those details because you could imagine the assumptions that would have been made about him. Something else he didn't tell. She said, when dad flew back that day to Boise, which is where they live, Boise, Idaho, and after being talking all day long to the news media, the phone is ringing off the hook. Everyone wants to talk to Kenneth Arnold. In the parents' bedroom that night, Ken Arnold's bedroom with his wife, they experienced orbs of light in their home, red, blue balls of light, which are an increasingly common, a very frequent aspect, you know, in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, that mm-hmm. once seen. When all the police cars are chasing the UFO along the road, and then the balls of light follow the craft or precede the craft. Orbs of light are actually a very common thing. So Kenneth Arnold in Mount Rainier, Washington, experiences 9 living beings, if you will, pulsating like light, which were represented as mechanical to the mechanical mindset of the time. He flies back to Boise, comes home, and their home is filled with light. This suggests something that transgresses the boundaries of mind and matter that Western science insists on. Western science's story of mind and matter as divided by an inseparable bridge is exactly that. It's a story.
Yeah.
It's not the essence of the scientific process. The scientific method can explore the paranormal. The paranormal is not pseudoscience. The paranormal can be explored in pseudoscientific ways, for sure. But by its nature, the paranormal is not out of bounds to study. Telepathy is not out of bounds to study. None of it is. So I take that view. I'm actually scientific. but in the broad sense of the scientific method. And so I say to the materialists who say things like, the scientific materialists, the physicalists who say, well, we know these things couldn't happen because, or no, it didn't happen because it can't happen. Oh, really? Why can't they happen? Well, because we know from the laws of nature. No. There are regularities of nature. There are patterns of nature. And guess what? These are patterns you don't want to look at because they require us to maybe reverse, Josh, the very equation that instead of the material world being primary, and somehow we've got to explain how the material world developed self-awareness, maybe consciousness is primary. The base. And we are born into a culture that has pushed so much off to the side. Maybe the physical world that we're in right now is, in fact, there are some schools of philosophy in neuroscience right now that suggest the physical world is actually a dense form of consciousness. Maybe it's all consciousness. Again, I'm not unpacking those deep issues, but the consciousness piece is crucial. Yeah. And it's in the Ken Arnold founding story. So I love discovering that. It opens up the territory wide.
Well, it does, as well as in the sense of social engineering, because the way the mainstream media ran with the story in the sense of flying saucers, we know yes. during this point in time in the history of the country, the U.S. military and the intelligence communities were well aware of these types of phenomena. We know that they were well aware of it. Nazi Germany, they obviously had recovered this. This is post-World War II. So we know that they were aware of it. And so it would be at the guise of them that they would say, hey, look, media, this is what they were. This is what you need to report, instead of actually reporting what they believe they actually were. I mean, and think about how the flying saucer idea itself was ingrained into the minds of humanity for the last, 50, 60 years. Exactly what we just talked about there is it goes back to that social attribution that sits in your brain of your mind trying to interpret what it's seeing, and it goes back and correlates it with a saucer. Eventually, that's going to transition to a triangle and so forth. But if Kenneth Arnold had came out and told that story, and that story was actually told, just think what the UFO phenomena would be today in the sense of the minds of humanity.
And, it probably, when I think about that, I think it's a very good point. It's a very good point. I think actually if he had come out with the full story, it would have been dismissed his story would not probably have been the founding story, because that was too, it would have appeared that Ken Arnold was troubled.
Yeah.
Okay, to put it, I mean, that level of detail, I don't think there's any anything that, everything happens for a purpose. He said what he saw. By the way, if he didn't describe them as shaped like saucers, but he said they skip like saucers, would skip? Isn't it interesting that, in fact, what has been continued, then over the years, what has been perceived very often is flying saucers? How does that happen? I think it is actually possible, and this puts me in, puts me out there in among those who are out mm-hmm. there. But I think the evidence, we've got to go with the evidence. But I think it's possible that this phenomenon is sentient. It is precognitive. There are many, many cases of people knowing that they're going to have, ordinary people sense that they're about to see something, and they look up and they do see something. So this is a sentient phenomenon that interacts with a physical world. It is precognitive. We know that. Well, we know it. There's great evidence from the Skinwalker Ranch phenomenon and the TV series called Skinwalker Ranch. Mm-hmm. If our listeners and viewers don't know that show, I would suggest they look up Skinwalker Ranch in Utah. In any case, the phenomenon says, in effect, this intelligence recognizes that we're expecting it to be saucers. It conforms to yeah. saucers. By the way, only 50 years prior to Ken Arnold, 1947, 1896, there's an entire phenomenon that I will be describing in the book, and I'll keep brief here, the Texas airship mystery. Mm. Throughout the southern states, airships that were, this is the pre-Wright brothers, so there were, they weren't flying yet, that were almost Wizard of Oz-like dirigibles, were landing in Texas cornfields, seen by sheriffs and deputy sheriffs, and strange, absurd conversations happened between humans and the beings on this ship. One of the sheriffs said, "Where are you from?" He said, "Today I'm from Greece, but tomorrow from anywhere." Well, that is in Zen, yeah. Zen Buddhist practice. That's called a koan. That is a primary, that is like the question, what was your face before you were born? When you're asked that in a meditative setting by a Zen man, what was your original face? It stops the mind.
Yeah.
And in that moment where the mind stops, there can be an illumination, which is the whole point of Zen practice. Well, is it possible that the UFO is a well-orchestrated koan, K-O-A-N, if you want to look up that word? It refers to a nonsensical challenge to the mind, which has the effect of stopping the mind because the mind tries to figure it out and stops in its tracks. So when you ask them where they're from, today we're from Greece, tomorrow anywhere, and that gets reported, first of all, it gets debunked. That couldn't have happened. Right. The sheriff must have been drinking. So this is the structure. It reveals itself, Joshua. It reveals itself in a way that further conceals it. Every revelation it makes of itself, it also conceals it because that couldn't have happened. What? And that's, by the way, just briefly, we're about to go to these hearings on March 17 when Congress apparently has finally had enough. They've had these classified briefings. They've been shown some pretty far out stuff. And apparently the Pentagon has kind of said, well, we're just going to keep it between us, right? This, we don't know what to make of it. Several members of Congress said, actually, no, we're going to have public hearings. We're going to put you under oath. They've got to protect methods of intelligence. They've got to protect sources. We don't want to put our intelligence sources at risk. But we're about to put to the military and to the intelligence services some tough questions. That's just this coming Tuesday, the 17th. So in any case, what I think they're probably going to have to acknowledge is they don't know what this is. Yeah. It is so surpasses our technology. Oh, the Tic Tac sightings of 2004 on the Nimitz aircraft carrier. I can't begin to do that story justice, but what was recorded on radar, the in these phenomena, these apparent craft tic-tac shape,
yep,
dropping 70,000 feet in to the sea level in 3/4 of a second, in less than 1 second, 70,000 feet, and then zooming 60 miles in 1 second beyond.
Yeah. I got out of,
and then disappearing on the spot, not just zooming out into space, but literally dematerializing, or what appears to be popping back out of this realm. That's why I think we have to look at it, at the possibility that I call it. You add up the extraterrestrial, then there's the interdimensional. Some call it the ultra-terrestrial. Mm-hmm. This is a form of intelligence that's right here. So I take all the theories, ultra-terrestrial, extraterrestrial. I've created the term omni-terrestrial.
I like
that. Omni meaning all, or everything, or the whole. It is all levels of Earth. It is an Earth, broadly defined. All levels of body, all levels of mind. And no, that's not comforting.
Yeah.
No, that's not easy to explain. Our science isn't there yet. This is prodding our science to move. It's like a horse when you smack a horse with a what do you call it? The crop.
Yeah.
It's to get the horse to gallop. Well, this is trying to get us to gallop. It's trying to get us to grow up.
I find it interesting that you mentioned the Tic Tac UFOs. I've told a lot of people this story. I actually did an interview with Linda Moulton Howe in 2012. Right. I got out of service in 2010. I finally got my VA benefits in 2012, and I felt safe enough to tell the story. And the story that we had was we deployed to the South Pacific, And so we're just off the coast of Peru, about 300 miles by the Galapagos Islands. You can't operate within a 100-mile radius of the Galapagos Islands because it's protected waters. So what would happen is drug smugglers would go into those protected waters and they'd use them as waypoints to transfer narcotics or human beings and human trafficking operations because they knew we couldn't go in them. So that's the area of operation that we operated in. And one night, I go out, I was on radar watch. I worked in weapon control and, worked on the radar systems on my watch. My duty was standing watch. So worked on the fire control radar, has a range about 25 nautical miles. I check out my air search radar, 250 nautical miles, nothing on there. Surface search radar, 55 nautical miles, nothing there. I'm like, hey, I'm going to go have a smoke. And I go to portside midships and I watch this red light on the horizon just rise up. And we're in the middle of the ocean. We're running dark. So the only thing we have on is a mast light on our ship. Everything else is dark. It's crystal clear skies. I mean, the most amazing skies you've ever seen in your life. And I see this red light. And I go, oh, my God, that's a flare. Someone must be having an emergency, a small boat or something like that. So I go and I call the bridge. Like, hey, we got a red flare portside midship. Just came up on over the horizon. They're watching it with the big eyes. I go back up to combat. And they said, you know, Josh, there's a problem here. I go, what's that? And they go, usually when someone shoots a flare in the air, the flare falls down. And I said, oh. They're like, do you have anything on radar? I'm like, we have nothing on radar. So we start moving towards it. And at the same, so we don't gain any traction on it. It's as if it's moving away from us as we're moving towards it. So we launch the SH-60 Bravo, the helicopter we have, towards it. And the helicopter, it starts moving away from the helicopter, eventually stops. The helicopter gets on top of it, and we get it on FLIR, the FLIR camera, which is an infrared camera. And it's about the size of a SUV. And it drops into the ocean and begins to dissipate. And so the dissipation was just the heat signature and the red light began to disappear as it sped up going down into the ocean. And that was one of many experiences we had in 2004 in the ocean. And it was a spherical object. It was nice and big, round, spherical object. But it was glimmering red. Like just, it looked like a flare in the sky. It looked like a burning circle in the sky.
Well, the pilot, the F-18 pilot, I believe it's Frager, mm-hmm. In the Nimitz, if I've got his name right, I don't want to call him by his wrong name, but he was originally drawn. By the way, they had been seeing this stuff during their maneuvers in the aircraft carrier maneuvers. Finally, somebody said, go down to this, go, pursue it, check it out. And they found it coming out of the water, essentially. So there is a very well developed theory, or at least a speculative approach, that suggests that there's as much evidence they come from under the oceans. We haven't surveyed the oceans fully,
yeah.
And it may be that they are off planet and also underwater. Jacques Vallée, the French astrophysicist who's done such good work, astronomer and UFO author, has said, look, given the way this works beyond time and that comes in and interacts with time and space, they could be from anywhere or any time, which actually brings open the possibility of time travel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are very far out things, but the new physics, new approaches to physics speak of wormholes. I'm not conversant in quantum theory. I do know enough about quantum theory to know that if you've got 10 quantum physics theorists in a room, they'll all say it's a lot of high strangeness, but boy, will they disagree on what to make of it, because it's clearly related to this macro world we live in, but how it is it the process, you know, non-locality and the kind of fundamental interconnectedness that seems to be suggested in paranormal phenomena. It opens up all of these questions. So yeah, that's a great story. That's a very powerful experience.
Yeah, it was one of the few that we had on that deployment. And my buddy, actually, who came on our ship when we got back in from deployment, he came from the Princeton, which was on with the Nimitz battle group doing those exercises. They were one of the ships that had those massive experiences, and he told us all about it. And our next deployment, we went out and we had more experiences. And there's something about that part of the ocean, the Pacific Ocean, And when you start getting out 400, 500 miles off the coastland of California, and even if you transit down south and you go a few hundred miles, like off the coast of Peru, South America, where there's absolutely nothing on that whole side of the planet, there's something very eerie and strange about being out there. I've been out there many times, and I'll tell you, it's the most surreal experience you've ever had in your life, in the sense of serenity, in the sense of oneness with nature. I mean, the only thing that you hear is the sounds of the waves. The only thing that you see and smell is the salt in the water, and then you see the night skies and the starlit skies and the reflection of the stars off the still ocean, which is absolutely one of the most amazing things in the world. But there's also something out there that's just, I don't know, it's just eerie, and I've had cryptid experiences. We saw a massive, like, 7-foot bird out there. We've seen, we chased one with a P3 Orion in the air. We chased this one that was doing exactly what you were saying there before. It was going up in altitude, 50, 60,000 feet, moving freaking 80 miles in a split second, then dropping altitude at ocean level, going back up. And we chased this thing for 3.5 hours until we eventually said, let's get out of here. You know, it's black. They call it Blackbeard's pirate ship because it was in the Caribbean. We had just crossed over into the Panama Canal, and we got this thing on radar. And the P3 Orion had it, and they sent us out to go investigate about 60 miles away. We finally get it on radar, and it's just running all over the place, 100 miles here, 60 miles there. And the P3 is like, would get over top of it, like, there's nothing here. There's nothing here. And all of a sudden, it would rise up to 70,000 feet in altitude. And they're just like, it just must be Blackbeard's pirate ship. And there's hundreds of accounts of sailors in modern day of seeing Blackbeard's pirate ship in the Caribbean. And they see it as a contact or a blip on a radar, of which they chase and never find.
All of it is fantastic. And you described the cryptids, the mantids, the various forms, these beings, let's just call them. When we're talking about human interactions with beings, especially in the abduction realm, there's a process that I'm going to describe in my book. Mm-hmm. And I want to do it very respectfully toward the researchers like Bud Hopkins, the famous abduction researcher who wrote Missing Time. And he popularized the idea that people are taken from their cars and their homes into ships and by the grays, the short aliens, that they're experimenting with our genetics, and they're creating a hybrid race. Okay, interesting. When I got to know Bud Hopkins, he had a process of selecting. He had a filter that he didn't know that he had. When someone would say they had a mantid, or a cryptid, or a creature that did not fit the little grays, Bud would, without knowing it, would say, "Well, that one is probably imaginary." See, there's a process of unknowing confirmation bias and cognitive bias, whereby the desire to have a pattern that fits has an effect of a kind of reducing valve. It takes the richness of the actual reported phenomena and narrows it down. So John Keel was a researcher back in the 1960s who wrote a book called Operation Trojan Horse. He started out as an advocate of the ET hypothesis. He went very fast into the view that this is a long-term phenomenon. In his view, very often mischievous and often malevolent. He would travel around the country as a reporter, as a professional reporter. He would arrive at a hotel and want to check in, and they say, "We have your reservation, Mr. Keel." He'd say, "Well, I didn't make a reservation. We have it here. Is this your address?" I mean, he got involved in a paranormal funhouse, if you will. Reservations were made for him. His phone would ring off the hook. He would be followed by long limousines, the men in black. This has a dimension to it. It's not just the men in black could not just be U.S. military. They act like military intelligence. Yeah. But there's a phenomenon that reads us. It's reading us as we're trying to read it. And it is goading us, playing with us in ways I'm still figuring out how to describe how I'm going to talk about this. But it is a call from the cosmos. You know, if it is extraterrestrial, okay, let's just say, at least some of it is extraterrestrial in the classic Spielberg sense. Well, in that case, the call is to hey, Earthlings, you're part of a larger galactic world. You got to get better at managing your planet. We want you to, we're not going to make contact with you more formally until you get better at relating to yourselves. So there's that. But if they're interdimensional, then it's a call from the cosmos to say, you are three dimensions of space and one of time. Your four dimensions that you acknowledge, that's not a bad start. Here's the deal. You live in 20 dimensions. That's how you're even interacting with us. Open up. Open up your philosophy. Open up your cosmology. So in that sense, it's a call from the cosmos to own a larger game. I'm going to add this. Just because we've decided for the past 500 years of the materialist scientific method to get rid of angels and angelologies and demons and demonologies doesn't mean they've given up on us. Oh. In other words, because they're no longer part of our maps doesn't mean that such beings don't exist. And in fact, we are less able to respond because we don't believe in them. I'm not saying classical angels are the actual final form, but it's a phenomenon that is, there is a vast middle realm of phenomena. This is what I want to say. The UFO phenomenon invites us to open to the possibility that between mind and matter, there are middle realms, subtle matter. For example, most of the mythological and religious traditions of the world have doctrines, as you know, from the occult traditions, theosophy, Rudolf Steiner, of subtle bodies, subtle material, astral realms, etheric body. Well, what if, and as a matter of fact, I happen to think many of the abduction experiences are happening in the body, but they're happening in a star body or an etheric body. This is why Calvin Parker was paralyzed. Paralyzed and floating into, you know, people say, well, he was, some technology did that to him. It didn't do something to his body that his body was. He's already composed of the elements that are beyond the material realm. And he experienced that night. Then he was poured back into a body. And he, to this day, he thinks that he lives in his body. We all do. We have to navigate the material world. But you're getting where I'm kind of leading.
I love this because running through my head is so many different examples of this through mythological history. You can go to Hermes and the Divine Pymander, where he talks to the crocodile god, the alligator god, the representation of God. You got Arjuna and Krishna, where he sees the thousand faces in an instant of God vibrate and manifest in front of him. You got Ezekiel and his visions. And all of these, if you take them into the context, is not physical experiences of witnessing something in the physical, but in the sense of a deep meditative trance-like state where you're being pulled out of your body and experiencing something in a higher dimension or even the astral world, the context of it, of what they're explaining, which seems beyond our mind here in the physical realm, it makes complete sense.
Well, you know, Hermes is one of my favorite gods. He is the guardian of thresholds.
Yeah.
What is the UFO, but if not a transgressor of the various thresholds? It's both here and over here. It's up and it's down. It's inside and it's outside. This phenomena is neither simply objective nor simply subjective. It's both. So Hermes, not only is he the guardian of thresholds, but he's the guardian of communication. So we're trying to communicate with something. Then the other Greek god I love is the god Proteus, from which we get the word protean. A protean phenomenon is a multiple, takes many forms, many shapes. Protean means diverse, many, manifold. Well, the phenomenon is indeed anything but singular. It is, there's a doubleness to it, and it has fun with us. So I have fun with it. Sometimes I've had people who've taken me aside and said, Keith, you're kind of lucky. You've been exploring this for a long time. And it hasn't damaged you. And I asked someone once, he said, what do you mean? He said, well, you know, there's a history of people who have these encounters, and even researchers, they don't end up well. Psychologically. And I said, you know something? I think I know what you're getting at. I think the researchers and even the experiencers who have not had a framework that is larger than the conventional material mind-body realm, if they don't have a cosmology that allows them to open to it, they can be driven crazy by this phenomenon. And some of the researchers, I won't name names because I respect them all and I'm not looking for wars, but there are researchers in the UFO field that are extremely dogmatic and extremely troubled, I think. It doesn't end well for people who, if you're categorically certain what this is, it's going to have a bad effect on you.
Yep.
If you're open to not knowing and you have an awareness, as I have studied over the years, of philosophy and esoteric traditions, I think it leaves me alone, so to speak, because I have a spiritual orientation. You know, the old saying is, one of the great quantum researchers, I think he said, or philosophers, I'm not sure who, I've got to get the name right. He said, I never said it was possible. I only said it was true.
I don't
know how this is happening. I know that it is happening.
Sounds like fine.
And Whitley Strieber was deeply troubled by his experience. Yeah. By the way, we're coming close to the end, yeah. I think. But I'll tell you a quick story. After he wrote Communion.
Which happened, by the way, about an hour and a half from where I live, where I was born and raised.
Is that right? Yeah. Well, he wrote Communion based on this experience in the cabin out in the woods. And then they went public with it, which I think Whitley has sometimes wondered whether that was the right path. But it's become who he is, and he stands up and stands for it. They invited people to write them. They put their post office box on the book. And they got thousands, many thousands of letters from people. And his late wife was the archivist for that particular project. She would spend days with some volunteer researchers collating them and pulling out the themes and looking at the patterns. One day she came out and said, Whitley said, what are you finding? She said, Whitley, from everything I'm studying, this has a lot to do with what we call death. So there's a big one. Drop that one in the UFO field. Are we looking at the possibility to understand this phenomenon of interaction with so apparent aliens? We're also looking at the realm that I experienced in my death experience and others. In other words, I'm going to be developing overlap, almost like a Venn diagram, the UFO encounter experience, the near-death experience. What are the common elements? Yeah. And there are many. This is a larger framework that is revealing itself to us. And if we try to look at it only in pieces, it will drive us crazy.
You know, in that perspective right there, because I know exactly what you're talking about. And this is, so the Red Pill Project, I created this because I got censored heavily on all different types of platforms because of my opinion, because of where the information I was researching was leading me, and I was very verbal about it, and that got me banned. And so I created the Red Pill Project, and I said I have to have a motto for it. And I picked that never believe anything anybody tells you, no matter who they are or what authority they profess or possess, unless you can prove it with your own will, through your own volition, and through your own experiences. And so the interesting thing about this is that the one thing that you should leave out of that, though, is your conceptualization of belief. Because when you bring your beliefs into the interpretation of the information, you automatically assume that your perspective is right. But instead, I utilize a level of intuition to interpret reality, right? In the sense that all information is manipulated in some way, shape, or form, and that when information comes into my sensory system, is that you have to be hypercritical of what that information is. You have to look at it in a very discerning way and not just accept it as it is. And so people who are very dogmatic, people who are based upon a certain belief structure or oriented or indoctrinated into a belief structure, they're always going to look at information in that perspective that they were indoctrinated, trained, or organized to. One example I use, and he's passed away now, I guess we can talk about him, is Bill Cooper. I think Bill Cooper was a fascinating human being. He did a lot for these different truth communities as well as the UFO and alien community. And I think he's wrong on about 80% of the things that he talks about because he doesn't understand the occult from an occult or esoteric perspective. He understands it from a very, very Christian perspective, which you cannot take something that is outside. You cannot take something that you're inside of and look outside of it and say, oh, this is what it's compared to on the inside, and this is why it's bad or good or whatever it might be. Is you have to go out to the outside, and you have to dip your feet in it, and you have to experience it, and you have to go out there and find the truth within it for yourself. And when that happens, it completely changes your paradigm.
Well, one of the basic practices, I think, whether you want a spiritual or whatever one believes about matters related to spiritual practices such as meditation can be extremely helpful to simply notice the mind stream that will be of thoughts all day long, and that thoughts are just what they are. They're passing through the sky like clouds. The tricky area we get into in any part of life is to believe thought. It's okay to have the thoughts. It's even okay to form beliefs. But always remember that those are to be held tentatively. And when we believe our thoughts, this is the teacher Byron Katie with her four questions about, is it true what you're believing? Suffering is really based on believing our thoughts. And so have thoughts, have systems, have concepts. Don't be run by them. And some kind of practice of, you know, daily practice, weekly practice of sort of sitting in silence and noticing, gee, the mind is just announcing things all day long. And notice that that's not you. You're the subject of that instead of being subjected to it. If you don't know your mind is a stream that's running on, you'll be identified with a mental stream. And, we get in all kinds of trouble every day of our lives with, she wasn't very friendly to me. Maybe she doesn't like me. Maybe I'm not good enough. Actually, she was maybe focused on her own life. It's nothing about you. You run with that belief, you'll really ruin your day. Maybe ask her, you seem kind of abrupt. Oh, I'm sorry. I was thinking in my own world. So check out stuff. Check out the beliefs we form, because very often they're not true.
That's it. Well, and in that, I know we got a few more minutes. Well, it's time, but I'll just go over a few minutes because I wanted to finish this thought. When we start looking at truth in its totality, I come out and say that there's only two truths in the universe. And that is, there's the absolute truth, which is unknowable. It's incomprehensible. It's beyond mind and unimaginable to us human beings, because I believe that we're in this finite form right now. And then there's the self-evident truth, and that is a subjective interpretation of the absolute, which is our own experience of what that truth is. And the only truth that we can ever know is that subjective truth, but it's ever evolving to understand what that absolute is. But it'll never obtain that absolute, because the absolute therefore grows with it in the interpretation of the individual.
In Buddhism, that breakdown is between the absolute and the relative. And the and I believe what happens in many UFO experiences is what is called a non-dual experience, a state of absolute wholeness and oneness. And psychedelics as well can be experiences when they are successful and productive, an experience of the wholeness, the oneness, the suchness of things that is beyond words and expression. Then we come back into, when the trip wears off, or when we come back from the encounter experience, we're back in the body of subject is in here, object is back out there. We're back in the relative world. So part of the translation problem with the UFO phenomenon is having a profound experience of beyond the division of mind and matter, then coming back to being in the body and separating, oh, that happened to me. Actually, what happened was an interaction between, I think there's a shared ground. One thing I want to develop is, I think the abduction, the hidden secret of the abduction experience is that the human and the alien are interacting in a shared space. What's the nature of that shared space where people are transported through walls? I mean, experientially, it's real. People have real experiences. What's the nature of that, and how does it relate to this realm? Those are big questions, including questions that got Dr. John Mack in a lot of trouble at Harvard. We have another conversation sometime. His research, which was bold and brave, and again, got him in a lot of trouble at Harvard, because they said, John, are you really believing this stuff? And he says, I believe it's pointing us to the limitations in our maps. Yeah, that's what I believe. And he said, by the way, don't we have something here called academic freedom? And to the credit of Harvard, they said, you know something, we think John Mack is kind of nutty, but he's an academic. This is an academic institution, and we don't have to agree with him about what's going on in the abduction experiences. But if we close down on John Mack, well, it was before the current crazy cancel culture that we're dealing with, but there's a lot of problems now with free thought and free speech. And John Mack was a warrior for that in this field. You don't have to agree with his conclusions, but Harvard correctly said, hey, this is a great university. Great universities allow diverse thinking.
Wow. Keith, this was fantastic. You know what? I'm gonna have Andrea schedule you again because there's so much more to do. There's so much more in depth that we can go in so many different angles. So I can't wait to have you back on.
Well, let me just tell you, yeah. I'm happy to do it even while I'm working on my book because it's helping me. You know, I will look at this as a little colloquium we're having. Like in psychology, they call it a practicum. Mm-hmm. You discuss with your fellow psychologists cases you're working on. And what are you working on? Well, I've got a patient who's this way. So I'm thinking out loud about what I'm working on in my book. So and by the way, I've learned I don't talk with many people about the UFO phenomenon. When people in casual that I don't know, what are you writing these days, Keith? I don't necessarily start with UFOs because it often doesn't go well. I don't necessarily want the conversation with the uninformed person on this subject. You know that. I mean, you can end up at a party. It's a great way to stop. Keith, you're working on a book about UFOs, and just watch the silence in the room. So I look at this. This has been very beneficial to me is what I'm
saying.
Oh,
that's awesome.
Too. Being able to download these ideas and try them out and knowing the next time we talk, my views may be different.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate it as well. And anytime you want to talk, you just let me know. We'll bring you on. We can have a conversation because this is fantastic. You guys can find him at thompsonatlarge.com. It is linked up in all the description boxes below. We'll be at the After Dark chat, Fringe After Dark, in about 35 minutes from now. You can find that on socialredpill.com under the subscriptions. And we'll see a few of you guys there. Everybody else, we'll see you tomorrow night on Makes You Think and Mars Chronicles. Much love, respect. God bless you guys all. Take care. Have a great night.